Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Today is day four on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe in our spring-summer fund drive. And we are going to be talking about a wonderful book. I recorded an interview recently with the author, one of the co-authors of the book, Chasing Chilies, Hot Spots Along the Pepper Trail. And I've got a handful of these books available to people who make a donation to KSFR. So if you want to get a really terrific book on chilies, not just chilies in New Mexico, but chilies all over the world, give us a call, 505-428-1393, 428-1393, and you can get a copy of this book. And above all, you can make a contribution to KSFR, your public radio station. I'm here with the wonderful and fabulous Bill Hutchison, who has long been a co-host of this program, especially when we talk about animals. Welcome.
Well, hello, Mary Charlotte. Very nice to see you this morning.
Good to see you, too.
I was distracted for a minute doing the people watching that's a must here at the Baking Company.
Indeed.
Probably one of the finest spots for people watching in Santa Fe.
You can do some chili watching here, too.
I love doing the chili watching. Don't get it too close to your eye, but one can say the same thing for the people.
428-1393. So before we talk to Craig Kraft about the book Chasing Chilies, let's talk for a moment about KSFR. Bill Hutchison, you have been on this program. You have had your own program, the Anthologist Cabinet of Musical Marvels, and you are a wonderful supporter of and contributor to public radio. Why should people call and give now?
Because KSFR scores about a 17 million on the Scoville scale.
Scoville?
That's the scale for measuring chili heat, the Scoville scale. Because it is one of the hottest public radio stations going. Santa Fe is a particular kind of unique jewel in the crown of this country, and a unique jewel like Santa Fe needs a unique jewel of a radio station. And boy, does it have it in KSFR. Not just because they let a Yahoo like me or an incredibly talented person like yourself have programs, but...
Al revés, the reverse.
Yes, but I think if we did an informal survey of the citizenry, we would find that my take was probably the more accurate one, sadly.
He is wearing, ladies and gentlemen, a T-shirt that says Pugs, Not Drugs, and it has a little cartoon of a pug dog on it.
I'm not saying the two have to be mutually exclusive, but if you have to choose one, pugs are pretty great.
They're certainly better than toxifying your brain for all time.
Without
but back to the fun drive.
A radio station like KSFR is hard to come by. A lot of good public radio stations in this country. I mean, we tune in to podcasts now, thanks to technology, from a lot of them, including podcasts from KSFR, including Mary Charlotte's own show. But it is such a particularly wonderful radio station. There is an incredible variety of programming. But more than that, this community is truly represented on KSFR. And I certainly see that for myself, whether it's wanting to play weird music on the awesome show that I had for 6 or 7 years on the station, to us getting to talk about animals in my role with the animal shelter and your role as a sort of miniature animal shelter of your own accord. This station represents this community. If you are a person who lives in this community, there is programming that is there for you, and often you are probably a part of that programming. It is the place where this community's voice is heard.
428-1393, 428-1393. We only have a limited number of the book Chasing Chilies, Hot Spots Along the Pepper Trail available. So give a call right now and score a copy of the book. And above all, give to public radio station KSFR, your public radio station for northern New Mexico, this whole area from Albuquerque to Taos that listens to KSFR. Give us a call, 428-1393. And we're going to talk now. We're going to go to this interview that I recorded with Craig Kraft. And while we're talking, you give us a call. Thanks. We're talking now to Craig Kraft. He's an agroecologist and co-author, along with Kurt Michael Fries and Gary Paul Nabhan, of the new book Chasing Chilies, Hot Spots Along the Pepper Trail. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte. So the three of you, the three authors who call yourselves gastronauts on a spice odyssey, and the book is full of a lot of bad puns, the three of you got into a van. You spent a year going to chili-growing places, talking to farmers, observing the realities of climate change on chilies. Why chilies in particular?
Well, aside from being Gary, Kurt, and my favorite foods, chilies, I think, as we know in New Mexico, are really integral parts of cuisine and culture. There is a huge diversity of chilies that we can observe all in North America, as we saw during the course of this book. It's a vegetable. It's a spice. It's a colorant. The Aztecs even use it as a weapon. You know, it's in a pepper spray. It's medicine. It fills a lot of different niches, and it captures people's imaginations in a way that rice or corn or soy just doesn't do.
So the book is as much a travelogue as it is an exploration of chilies, and you started in Sonora, Mexico, where you met Mexican farmers who'd been dealing with changes in climate for a really long time, not just the last sort of 20, 30 years. But now there were changes that surprised farmers, even who'd been dealing with all kinds of drought and rain cycles. One of them was that the heat is the increased temperature is, on the one hand, rendering some growing more difficult, and on the other, people are growing tropical fruits and strawberries and things that they'd never grown before. What's going on? How do you make sense of it?
Yeah, that's a great anecdote there from the first chapter. I mean, I think a theme that we saw throughout the book is one of adaptation and resilience. How do farmers adapt to different climates, increases in temperature, different rainfall regimes? The examples that you cited there were that as the temperatures increased in northern Sonora, the types of trees that would prosper changed, and so they planted things that their father and grandfather never thought of planting in that area. When I was a graduate student at UC Davis, one of my colleagues published a study looking at the impact of climate change on the fruit and nut crop of the Central Valley of California. It's a multi-million dollar industry, and it in this area they grow a number of tree crops that require a certain amount of chilling hours. These are hours below, I don't know the specific, I think it's below 20 degrees Fahrenheit, that will ensure that the tree fruits and blossoms the next year. As the climate warms up in the Central Valley, there are fewer and fewer orchard areas that reach these minimum chilling hours needed for a lot of crops. So we're going to see things like peaches and apricots and apples in California start to move north. And I think we could draw a parallel situation to apple orchards in the Rio Grande Valley. As the temperature heats up, the orchardists, the farmers are going to have to look for other varieties that are more tolerant of warmer conditions. Or they're going to have to move north or to higher elevations.
And there's kind of an analogy to creatures, to animals, who, when the temperature warms, they go up mountains until they reach the top of the mountain. They can't go any further. It's kind of the same thing.
That's exactly right. At a certain point, there is no higher ground to run to or no places further north. The other issues the farmers were facing were ones of extreme weather events. We had gone into Sonora just after Hurricane Ximena, and it brought your 100-year flood to certain regions of Sonora, washing away a lot of infrastructure and in the places that we visited, orange orchards. these types of extreme weather events are going to happen with greater frequency. We just have to, I mean, we look at our neighbors in the Mississippi River Valley. They've going through another very tough springtime with horrible flooding. And I think if you look at the last 15, 20 years, they've probably had three or four flood events that previously would have been called the flood of the century.
And when you look at those events, you have to look at not only global climate change, but the eradication of wetlands and of the natural barriers to flooding.
Yes, that's exactly right. I think something that comes out in different chapters of our book, especially when we looked at Tabasco and its relationship with the delta at the mouth of the Mississippi there, there are a number of factors involved in the decline of the cultivation of chili pepper in a lot of these regions, and it's not solely related to climate change. Climate change is another factor to consider, but there are changing demographics, high cost of labor, the globalization of our supermarket and our produce. These are things that all conspire to make a very difficult environment to grow chili peppers at the moment.
So how are the people involved in Tabasco production surviving?
Tabasco, probably 20 or 30 years ago, made the decision to spread its risk out and start growing the chili peppers for Tabasco overseas, mostly in Latin America. At the same time, they needed to figure out how do they balance the quality and the control of their product. All Tabasco is made with salt that is mined from Avery Island. It's a small salt dome in the marsh where the factory is located and where Tabasco has its origins. On the island, they still maintain a small 20-hectare plot of chili peppers, which they use to harvest seed. So they manage the seed on Avery Island. They send the seed out along with salt mined from the island to all of their growers throughout Latin America. And at the end of the harvest, the grower picks the ripe fruit, mashes it with the salt, and then ships that back to Avery Island, where the final process is elaborated. So they've been trying to deal and find a way to manage all of these different factors. They've nearly lost their factory a number of times to hurricanes and to floods.
We're talking to Craig Kraft, agroeconomist and co-author of the book Chasing Chilies. And ladies and gentlemen, yes, this book, Chasing Chilies, can be yours for donation to KSFR. 428-1393 is the number, 428-1393. It's full of terrific stories. It's as much of a travelogue as it is a book about chilies. Bill Hutchison, are you a chili eater?
I'm a straight-up chili chaser. I was born south of Albuquerque. I'm very much a native New Mexican. And from a very early age, we were eating very hot chili, my brother and I. And while I don't pursue the endorphin kick of exercise or any sort of extreme anything, and give me the hottest chili you can find. If I'm not crying and sweating and turning red and wishing I was dead a little bit, then it just wasn't hot enough.
428-1393. To replicate that experience through a book, you can read Chasing Chilies.
You know, it's been fascinating to listen to the interview because I think they don't necessarily talk about it very much, but talking about how the Mayans weaponized chili, like, yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like I've been down at Horseman's Haven and had some weaponized chili before myself.
Right, right. Stage 4, what is it called down there? Level?
Yeah.
How many levels does it go up to?
I think my brain has been fried by so much chili that portion of my memory that would make you make rational decisions after you've had it the first time and not go back a second time is gone.
Bill Hutchison, 428-1393 is the number to support KSFR and to support, you know, there's a reason that I chose this book to do an interview during the fundraiser, and that is that it is really important to think about what local community radio means. When you have people coming in from New Jersey and Michigan and places like that, until they've been here for a while, I would have to say that unless there's some kind of ethnic thing going on in their family, they don't get the chili thing.
They don't. They don't understand the flavor of our community, as it were.
Right, exactly. And so one thing that you have when you have local radio is you actually do programs for the community that tap into an understanding that the community has and really help awaken and open that up.
Without a doubt. So KSFR is neither the red nor the green. We are the Christmas of public radio.
The only state that has a state question.
Yeah, I love our question. And I love the looks of befuddlement. And then the looks of enlightenment that come on people's faces as they listen to KSFR and understand what it's all about.
428-1393. Please give a call right now if you like the Radio Cafe, if you love New Mexico, if you love chilies, give a call.
428. If you love books, if you love Mary Charlotte talking to people about books.
428-1393. We're going to return to Craig Kraft from Chasing Chilies, and please call now.
I can't wait.
Let's talk about diversity among chilies. There are many, many kinds of chili peppers. Is it part of your job as a student of chilies, as an agroecologist, to count them, to understand these varieties?
Well, for my PhD dissertation, I looked at the genetic diversity and the origins of one species of chili pepper. It's true that chili peppers are really diverse around our globe. I think at last count there are some 50,000 or more varieties of chili pepper. What most people don't know is that there are five different species that humans have domesticated that we broadly all call chili pepper. Three of them were domesticated in North America, two in South America, but really one species, its botanical name is Capsicum annuum, is the one that's economically most important to North America. This is our New Mexico chili, jalapeno, your bell pepper, Anaheim, chili de arbol, paprika. It makes up most of the chilies that you can think of. And so within that species itself, there is a huge diversity. I mean, you see, colors of fruits from reds, yellows, whites, purples, green, and all sorts of sizes and forms.
And they're all the same species?
Yes. So all of those varieties I mentioned before are the same species. Jalapeno is the cousin of our New Mexico chili, which is a cousin to the bell. All of those are able to crossbreed.
And so within that species, they're able to crossbreed, but you have many varieties, and those are really cultivated separately for their particular qualities, for example, heat. How does that work? How do you cultivate the hottest chili pepper possible?
Well, that's a great question. I think the way they do that, you guys in New Mexico, there's the New Mexico Chili Institute that is probably one of the world's leading experts on these topics. What they do is they plant out one variety in large quantities, thousands and thousands of plants, and then they screen them for which of these individuals has the characteristics they like. And in this case, if it would be heat, they'd find the individuals that are the most pungent, the spiciest, and then repeat the process, selecting only the seeds from that individual. That's sort of a simplified way of doing that, of explaining that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like any breeding, I suppose. It's like dog breeding.
Sure. Yeah, and it happens. Farmers do it maybe over the course of time and not such a direct and quick way. I mean, if you look at native New Mexican chilies, we have these wonderful land races of New Mexico chili. Land races meaning that it is a variety of chili that is not owned by a seed company. These are farmer-maintained varieties, the most famous example being Chimayo. But there's Velarde, Dixon, Española. All of these different varieties are related to a pueblo and where they are grown. And over the course of time, you know, the 400 years that chili peppers have been in New Mexico, farmers have gone selecting the individuals that have adapted and do the best in those conditions. And then also for the different types of end uses they want. So, you know, our Chimayos are more famous probably for the red, the dried red form in its powder. And there are other native New Mexican varieties that are more commonly consumed in its green form. So there's selection as well for the different end uses that people have with chilies.
I'm glad you included in the book that we are the only state in the United States to have an official state question, which everybody who's listening probably already knows what that is because we live here and the question is red or green. But what's interesting is that, which I did not know, was that here in northern New Mexico, as you write, there are more varieties of heirloom chilies than in the rest of the United States combined. That's amazing. Why is this?
I think it mostly has to do with a long history of chilies to New Mexico. Chilies were brought up with the Spaniards during the conquest. And so in New Mexico, we've had the privilege of eating and using chilies in our diet for over 400 years, whereas in the rest of the United States, these are chilies are relative newcomers. They came across with the European settlement and conquest.
So what are the advantages of heirloom chilies versus hybrid strains of chilies in terms of just surviving climate changes?
Well, the way that they are managed, heirloom chilies have a greater genetic diversity within a named variety. So what a hybrid is basically they are every single one. If you go out and you buy a pack of seeds of Yola Wonder bell pepper, every single one of those seeds is genetically identical. Excuse me. All of the seed packets of that same variety, hybrid variety sold across the United States, have the same genetics. And yet a landrace population of, say, Chimayo are seeds that are saved over time that reflect different parentage, yet all managed and all sort of from the same group. And so there's going to be a wider diversity, a larger heterogeneity within that population than the Yolo Bell that I just, my example. Say that there was a condition or a pest that homed in on the Yolo Bell. Every single Yolo Bell that we had just planted from all of our thousands of seed packets is susceptible and would die. And yet you introduce the same sort of pressure, whether it be weather or a pest, or even say we're looking for a new flavor or a larger fruit. Given that there is so much heterogeneity within that group, it would be likely that we could find something that was resistant to this pest or a little more resistant to drought, which I know that New Mexican chili farmers are facing this now. Or you might find an individual that has a larger pod, for instance, or maybe even an orange pod. You know, there's more opportunities for this diversity to be found in those populations.
So with this bell pepper example, you've got the same basic vulnerability that caused the Irish potato famine.
That's exactly right. That's the point. I mean, I think, you know, our... some people would argue that our science and our ability to battle pests and disease with chemicals has advanced since the time of the Irish potato famine. But it's the same idea. These hybrids are wonderful from a certain standpoint in that they provide big, robust fruits and a lot of yield. But at the same time, they don't have the link to our culture and our history that these land races have. Aside from the genetic diversity that they harbor and their resilience to changing conditions.
How did you find, you wrote about this a little bit in the book, that our acequia system is working for chili farmers? Are acequias still an integral part of chili growing in New Mexico?
I believe it. I believe that they are. I know that I'm still in touch with a lot of folks in New Mexico, and I've seen some recent articles about concern for this year's chili harvest. And most of the news comes from Hatch downstream there, and they're a much different type of chili production that we see in northern New Mexico, and so. I think that the communal nature in which water is doled out in northern New Mexico, it's an important tradition that is going to help keep northern New Mexico chilies thriving, whereas the more industrial form of production down south, in addition to their challenges with finding enough water, they're competing in a whole different market. They've got a lot of competitors overseas where labor costs are maybe not as high, and so your future cans of New Mexico green chili may be coming from places like Chihuahua, Mexico.
We're talking to Craig Kraft about the new book, Chasing Chilies, Hot Spots Along the Pepper Trail. And we're back in the Santa Fe Baking Company, urging you to call 505-428-1393, 505-428-1393, or what's the toll-free number?
If you don't want to spend the money, or if you're out of the area, you can call 866-907-5737. If you like to spell things on your phone, that's 866-907-KSFR. That's right, very good.
That's right. If you can still spell
Pop
things
quiz,
on, this, on cell phones, you can't. A lot of time you can't even spell things anymore because the numbers, the letters aren't written on them. But anyway, I was thinking when Craig Kraft was talking about...
What were you thinking, Mary Charlotte?
Monoculture. And monoculture in crops is similarly destructive and dangerous as monocrops or monoculture in cultural milieus like radio.
Oh my God! I've been driving back and forth across the country a lot lately, and if you run out of audiobooks and your iPod doesn't have any songs on it, and you have to tune in to commercial radio as you cross the country, you can drive 2,000 miles and hear the same five songs over and over and over and over.
It's bad for you.
Oh, it's terrible.
It's bad for your mind, it's bad for your heart and your soul.
A, they're not good songs to start with.
And your stomach.
B, you're listening to, you still hear them when you sleep because there's no variety, there's no challenge to your brain. KSFR, variety, challenge to your brain, and resistance to pests.
And chilies. You can get the book Chasing Chilies, Craig Kraft, and several other authors, as we've talked about, Kurt Michael Fries and Gary Nabhan, have co-written this book. And it's just a wonderful book. It's a great read. 428-1393.
And Craig Kraft, two Ks.
That's right.
That guy, I tell you what, he's taken
Craig
all the...
Craig with a K and Kraft with a K.
Taken all the Ks out of the Scrabble pile.
That's true. But you can't use proper names in Scrabble.
Wait, you can't when you play. I play Gorilla Scrabble.
For the people who have IQs of gorillas?
That's right.
428-1393 is the number for the KSFR Fun Drive. And we are going to now check in with the control room and then go back to Craig Kraft. Now, if you would like us to thank you on the air,
We will gladly do so. And if you would like not to be thanked, if you would just like to be anonymous, that's fine, too.
If you want us to thank you on the air, we'll do that.
We
won't
can do
say
that.
Your name. We can either thank you out loud or thank you to ourselves.
Thank you and thank you. 428-1393. Let's go to the control room.
Now, there seems to be a major gap between, for example, the American Farm Bureau and the farmers themselves in terms of adapting to and even acknowledging climate change. What does that look like? What's going on?
Well, I think someone touched on this in the New York Times lately. It seems that the American Farm Bureau, it's a lobbyist group for large farmers and all of the larger corporate interests in industrial farming, which don't always have America's and the environment's and smaller farmers' best interests at the forefront. And so, as we mentioned in the book, the president of the America of this farm association, this lobbyist group, is a climate change denialist, and basically arguing that by accepting the premise that there is a change in climate, it is going to wreak havoc on the way that America farms today, which could be interpreted that it is going to have severe impacts in the way that the business and the business interests in who have, you know, their revenues tied up in maintaining our industrial farming system as it is, are concerned. Because most of the adaptations suggested to dealing with a changing climate or even trying to mitigate future changes in climate promote a different, more holistic type of farming, use of low-till methods, trying to capture and sequester carbon. These are all techniques that don't make these guys any money.
You know, it's interesting. In the statement, the American Farm Bureau statement against even acknowledging climate change or supporting any kind of climate change legislation and so on, they say, we do not want to go back to this kind of 40 acres and a mule way of thinking. And it struck me that when I interview organic farmers, that's exactly what they are doing. People with organic and biodynamic farms and who are thinking in that way, they're talking about using relatively small pieces of land, as little equipment as possible, and producing the healthiest and most diverse crops possible.
That's exactly it. I think there's different measures of productivity there. You know, we look at the smaller organic farmers, and we look at the diversity of foodstuffs and the amount of foodstuffs that they can produce on a small piece of land. Yes, it requires a little more thought, a little more planning, a little more sweat labor. Yet the industrial farm will look at that, and they judge their productivity by how much gasoline is burned in, right? How much are they getting out of a piece of land for how much they've, how many tractor plows across it? It's like comparing apples and oranges.
What would constitute a more forward-looking, not only ways of farming, which you talk about in the book, but farm policy, in your view?
I'm not up to date on some of the discussions going on. I know that the Farm Bill is coming up next year, and that a number of activists are already starting to figure out how to create conversations or discussions to change policy there. But I think that generally speaking, there's the benefits are geared at the wrong group. I know in California, it's really difficult for a farmer who has just a few head of cattle, a small flock of chickens, to get their animals butchered and processed in a USDA sanctioned facility, so that they're able to then sell this meat. There's a loss of places where you can get animals processed. And these are all tied up into the amount of regulations needed for such a facility. Ridiculous things like the USDA inspector who comes once a year needs to have his own restroom in some of these facilities. That's just one example. But I think a good hard look at who these policies that are in place, who are they actually benefiting, and we need to shift those priorities.
How are they doing it in other places like Mexico?
Well, Mexico, I don't know that they really have any answers for us as well. They're also quite divided between the really industrialized north that is really geared towards exporting fruits and vegetables to the United States and other places. And then in the south, you have more traditional farming systems who've also been sort of frozen out of the marketplace. These people are barely making enough or growing enough to feed themselves, and they end up they're the source of migrants that go to the States. And so I think this is not just a uniquely American problem, but it's a global issue as well.
The book Chasing Chilies is full of recipes as well as everything else. How did you get them? Tell us some of your favorites and maybe some of the stories behind them.
Sure. So, the team of gastronauts, if you will, was myself, an agroecologist, Gary, who's an ethnobotanist, and Kurt, who is the chef. So we leaned on Kurt to do some investigative work whenever we came across something that really was, a memorable meal, but something also that really tied deeply with the places that we visited. One of these was in northern Florida. In San Augustine, Florida, there is a relative of the habanero pepper called the daddle pepper. And it has quickly been assumed by this group of northern Floridians. They identify themselves as Menorcan. They have an origin story. 1750 or so, they came to northern Florida from the Mediterranean island of Menorca to work on an indigo plantation. That didn't work out. They fled to St. Augustine, established themselves there. Now their diaspora has grown to a community of about 30,000 people. They have a couple dishes that exemplifies, a mix of Mediterranean and North Floridian cuisine, and one of these is pirlo, spelled P-I-L-A-U. It's a rice dish, much like jambalaya or paella, in which they use a number of locally available meats, being northern Florida, shrimp or fish. And the final crown is this daddle pepper. So basically you make a little, I guess it's called a sofrito, where you saute the vegetables and the rice in the dish. You add the meat that you've previously cooked. For one example, say we're using shrimp. You don't want to overcook the shrimp, so you cook the shrimp on side, and then you add it to the sofrito, and then you put some chicken stock or some water on top of the rice and let it cook together. In your sofrito, you've got little slivers of daddle pepper, and then when you serve it at your function, you serve it with a side of daddle vinegar, this amazing pungent vinegar with a little citrus taste. It was for me, it was a really new experience. Having grown up in New Mexico, I'm quite familiar with the way that we eat and we encounter spicy food. And I was really surprised to discover this little bubble in St. Augustine, Florida, and their love of the daddle pepper.
Did you ever, in your travels in the spice ship with the gastronauts find a chili that was just too hot to eat?
The habanero is in the Yucatan was the hottest one that we encountered. Eating it straight is really quite painful. There's a commonly used measure for pungency of chili peppers. It's called the Scoville unit. It's basically the technical word is organoleptic, but it's a tasting way to measure how hot a chili is. You take, you know, one part chili and dilute it in, say, 10,000 parts water, and if you can no longer, at the point at which you can no longer taste that chili is hot, you know, in the water solution there, you've given it a Scoville unit ranking. So our native New Mexican chili peppers have rankings around, you know, 15 to 20,000 Scoville units, jalapeno, you know, 5 to 10. And the habanero is at 300,000. So it's quite pungent. But if you go to the Yucatan and you see the way that the locals use it, they are just using the tiniest little slivers in their sauces. And so no one eats it straight. No one crunches it into a like a bell pepper or slices it in rings into their salad. You know, it's metered out appropriately.
Craig Kraft is an agroecologist. He's co-author, along with Kurt Michael Fries and Gary Paul Nabhan, of the book Chasing Chilies, Hot Spots Along the Pepper Trail. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. I enjoyed our conversation.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, you can get a copy of this book, Chasing Chilies, 505-428-1393. The very hottest chili in the world, Bill Hutchison, sitting here with me today.
Well, aren't you sweet? If they're gastronomers, are we radionomers?
We are radionomers because we are connoisseurs of radio.
That's right. Yes, we are. We go chasing the best radio across the world. And like most things, you can chase good things all over the world and find back when you get back home that's where it was all along.
There's no place like KSFR.
No place like KSFR, and that's why Mary Charlotte and I both love to call it our home radio station. And, you know, even as I've been gallivanting across this lovely country of ours, I love coming back and talking on the radio, not just because Mary Charlotte is one of my favorite people, but it's because she's also on my very favorite radio station. And we just get a chance to be part of something magical here.
428-1393, and we've just got a couple minutes left to make a donation to this wonderful station. There will only be books available until the dot of 9 o'clock, so if you call, well, maybe through the end of the news, but at the end of the news, the chili book turns into a pumpkin.
After that, you will have to call somebody who actually donated in time and get them to read it to you over the telephone.
Did you know that?
Which, frankly, will be awkward for both of you.
Did you know that chilies and pumpkins are actually in the same plant family?
Are they really?
Yep. Who knew?
I like a spicy pumpkin. I like chilies.
They don't taste alike at all.
You know what's very good, though, is pumpkin seeds with chili powder. You get the whole family together. They become kissing, delicious cousins.
That is
disturbing. That maybe was the wrong metaphor for family radio.
I was going to say it was delicious until it got disturbing. But yes, chili-dusted pumpkin seeds. 428-1393. It's the KSFR Fun Drive. And it is so important that we keep this station on the air.
It's drastically important.
It's drastically important, and
one
we don't do
commercials. One might say you're exaggerating
if
you say it's a matter of life and death. But frankly, it's a matter of mental life and death.
Well, I'll tell you, the whole issue of climate change, which is touched on in the book Chasing Chilies, and which is touched on in a lot of what we do, when you think about who is really covering this issue in the most depth, it's local, independent, public radio stations. Or sometimes Amy Goodman, who is not exactly local because she's on hundreds and hundreds, if not already 1,000 stations across the United States and across the world.
She's local to the hearts of so many.
Right. But it's independent, non-commercial, public radio.
Public radio is radio that gives a damn.
Radio that gives
a darn.
A darn. 428-1393. Radio that gives a chili.
I was trying to make it spicy up there.
Right. 428. 1393. We're just giving the number so many times so that you will call. And
you can
Bill
also
Hutcherson.
Pledge on the web, can you not, Mary Charlotte?
Oh, yes, you can.
And where would I, what would
you
I type into my browser of choice
can,
if I were going to do that?
And you may. 428, oh, sorry, what would you type in? KSFR.org.
Org is my favorite kind of domain name. I'm going to go do that right away.
428, I mean, I keep saying the number because it's become reflexive. KSFR.org, make a pledge on the web. Or call 428-1393 and get your chili book. Bill Hutcherson, thank you for spending this time with me.
Mary Charlotte, I can't imagine a better way to spend my time.
Well, thank you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. Bill Hutcherson with us for this hour talking about chasing chilies. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're going to go now to the control room, and we want to thank all of our volunteers. We want to thank everybody there for all the help, and above all, our listeners. We've got some thank yous coming up. All right, here we go.
Mary Charlotte and I are going to go see if we can eat the hottest chili.
We're going to go eat now.
Bye.